Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Framed ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Previously on Framed.
I lived in my car for a couple weeks. Then I lived at another friend's house.
What's his name?
It was Amanda.
You say you're afraid of something. What are you afraid of?
I'm not afraid of anybody. I'm afraid for somebody.
John, who are you afraid for? Just tell me. Just tell me who, John?
Vicky.
So you went to the movies with Brandon. What movie did you see?
Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey 2.
And what night was that?
Friday night. It was the day before the monks were killed.
What time did the movie end?
Say either 10 or 11. It was down at 67, that matinee theater.
Dollar movie?
Well, it wasn't a dollar. It cost $6, but we drove back. I didn't get home until after dropping Brandon off.
What he did with his money was he tried to attempt to buy the car. Basically what I did is I helped my parents with bills.
The sheer size and complexity of this jigsaw puzzle means that we need to study each piece carefully. But sometimes, when you focus on a single piece for too long, you lose sight of the bigger picture. So we're going to take a step back and talk through where we've been and where we're going. When we first received a copy of this case file, we were overwhelmed by it. The police reports were in no particular order, and those alone amounted to more than 50,000 pages. On our first pass through the documents, we did our best to get it organized chronologically. We wanted to put ourselves in the shoes of the investigators and follow their work through to the end. This is why we started the season by exploring the temple. If we knew everything there was to know about the crime scene, we would have something to check our suspects' stories against. That's precisely how we were able to eliminate the 5 Tucson suspects so quickly. The stories they told in the interrogation rooms weren't supported by the evidence found at the crime scene. In real life, the task force was unwilling to clear the suspects from Tucson. The 4 men who gave false confessions remained in jail for months. They sat in prison, awaiting trial, even though a new group of suspects emerged whose stories did line up with the known facts. Alex Garcia's confession was full of those details only the true killer could have known. He knew the phone cords were cut and that the fire extinguisher was sprayed in the hallway. He even knew where the band-aids were stored in the temple. That's not to say there weren't problems with his confession. For example, when Alex described the shooting itself, there was something that felt off about it. He said that when the shooting began, he was standing to the south of the circle in the doorway that led to the bedrooms. Jonathan was standing on the couch to his right. According to Alex, Jonathan started shooting the 3 monks that were crammed in between the couches. A few moments later, Alex fired 4 shots from the shotgun into the victims on his side of the circle. Jonathan then moved from right to left, circling the victims. Jonathan finished off the people Alex had wounded with the shotgun by shooting them in the head with the .22. The victims on Alex's side of the circle did sustain shotgun wounds, which was consistent with his story. But when they died, none of them were clutching the shotgun wounds on their shoulders, hands, or elbows. Their hands were situated to the sides of their heads, or they were under their faces. According to Alex, they didn't move at all after he shot them with the shotgun. They continued to lay face down on the carpet, waiting patiently for Jonathan to make it to their side. The victims crammed in between the couches all had their hands clasped in a prayerful, begging, or beseeching position at the top of their heads. It's almost as if they witnessed what happened to the victims on the other side of the circle, and they realized they were next. We think they moved their hands to a defensive position on top of their heads to shield themselves from gunfire. But, according to Alex, they were the first victims that Jonathan killed. In short, the crime scene tells a story that differs from Alex's story. How do we square this with our belief that Alex was at the temple? By season's end, we plan on resolving these types of conflicts. Our goal is to find out exactly what happened inside the temple that night, who was involved, who pulled the trigger, and why. That's where we're headed. But before we get there, we have a few more pieces to add to this puzzle. On our last episode of Framed, we talked about our persons of interest. On this episode of Framed, we're going to focus on our material fact witnesses, the girlfriends and ex-girlfriends, the close confidants, the classmates, the acquaintances, the rivals. When Raleigh was living out on his own, he frequently crashed at his friend Amanda's house, and he wasn't the only one doing so. In the summer of 1991, Amanda's was the unofficial home base for the AM Posse. They called it the House on the Hill. It was their go-to hangout spot. They would listen to music, watch TV, and sit by the pool. The house itself was located on West Maryland Avenue in Litchfield Park. If that street name sounds familiar, that's because the Wad Kunaram Temple was also located on West Maryland Avenue. Even though Amanda's house was on the same street as the temple, it wasn't a straight shot to get there. Luke Air Force Base was smack dab in between the two. It took about 13 minutes to drive from Amanda's to the temple. Whether you drove around the base to the north, or if you went around to the south, it was the same distance. The reason Amanda's was a popular spot for the AM crew was because her parents weren't living there anymore. In November of 1990, Amanda's family moved to Estrella, Arizona. They were having a really hard time selling their old home. So much so that in the summer of 91, they still had it. Amanda decided to stay at the old house over the summer since it was within walking distance to her job at McDonald's. She would stay there during the week and would typically spend the weekends with her parents at their new home in Estrella. Amanda was first interviewed by the task force on October 27, 1991. The detectives asked if she was in a romantic relationship with Raleigh, and she said it wasn't like that. He was more like an overly protective big brother to her. She found that he was easy to talk to. They talked about his ex-girlfriend Rhonda and his new girlfriend Joy. They also talked about the problems that were going on in Raleigh's life, like how his mother was having health problems and how his father was abusive. She knew Raleigh was having a hard time at home, so she let him stay at the house whenever he wanted. She left a window in the back unlocked so he could get in and out when she wasn't around. Like so many others in this case, they asked Amanda where she was on the evening of August 9th. Amanda said she couldn't really remember. Her normal routine that summer was to spend the weekend with her family at the house in Estrella. Her mother would pick her up at 2:30 p.m. on Fridays and bring her back home. She assumed that's what happened on the 9th. Something Amanda did remember was that when the news broke about the temple shootings, she was watching TV with her parents. Amanda's father also believed she was with them that weekend. His first reaction to hearing the news about the shooting at the temple was that he was relieved Amanda wasn't staying alone at the old house with a killer on the loose. In our last episode, we covered what Thomas told detectives during his initial interview. As a refresher, Thomas was Raleigh's friend. He was the one who stared down the barrel of a shotgun when some guys were looking for Raleigh one night. He was interviewed by Detective Munley on October 27th, around 6:15 p.m. A few hours later, Munley and his partner interviewed Thomas's brother Frank and his younger sister Joy. Frank and Joy were interviewed in separate rooms of their family's home. Their parents were also present for the interviews. For our purposes, we'll refer to them as Mr. and Mrs. Anderson. We'll start with what Frank told the detectives. Frank shared that he was a member of the AM Posse. His number was 8 because he had an 8-cylinder car. Frank was a bit of a grease monkey, so he favored the American Muscle interpretation of AM's meaning. On the weekend of August 10th, Frank remembered working on Jonathan Duty's Ford Mustang. He and Raleigh had taken the transmission out and were trying to fix the front and rear seals. When they finished the job, Jonathan told Frank to go see Alex Garcia for payment. So that's what he did. He went over there and Alex led him to his bedroom. There was a combination safe in the corner of the room. He opened up the safe and pulled out a small green metal box. Inside the box was a tall stack of cash, a silver bar with an inscription on it, lots of quarters, and several collector coins. Frank goes, "Where did you get all of that money?" To which Alex replied, "I stole it out of a car." Alex counted out $150 in singles and handed it over to Frank. At that point in the interview, Frank mentioned that he knew Jonathan was in big-time debt. In addition to the $150 he owed Alex for the car repairs, word was that he also owed a large sum of money to someone named Marvin. In the other room, Joy was telling Detective Munley that she was Raleigh's girlfriend. Frank had Raleigh over to the family home a few times that summer. That's how Joy came to know Raleigh. They had been seeing each other since June 27, 1991. In those early days of their relationship, they had to keep it a secret. They started going out before Raleigh broke up with his longtime girlfriend, Rhonda. The detective sensed a little tension in Joy's voice when Rhonda's name came up. Joy said she wanted to knock Rhonda out. She was upset with her because she would call Raleigh and make comments like, "I know we're going to get back together." Frank and Joy were both asked where they were and what they were doing on the evening of August 9th. Before we get to what their answers were, we need to tell you about something that happened before Detective Munley and his partner interviewed Frank and Joy. Earlier that day, Raleigh's mother, Mrs. Kara Tachea, called the Andersons' landline. Mrs. Anderson answered the phone. In a panic-stricken voice, Raleigh's mother asked if she could speak to Joy. Mrs. Anderson said that Joy was still asleep and couldn't come to the phone. Mrs. Kara Tachea broke down into tears and explained who she was and why she was calling. She said that Raleigh was being held in connection with the Temple murders. He wanted to be the one to tell Joy before she heard it from someone else. Raleigh's mother told her, "My son did not do this." Mrs. Anderson said not to worry and that they would be praying for her and Raleigh. Even though he may have been on the wrong track once in a while, she knew Raleigh wasn't capable of murder. Before the conversation ended, Mrs. Kara Tachea asked if she would relay a message to Joy and Frank for her, and it was this. She wanted them to know that Raleigh's sister's birthday party was the same night that the monks were killed at the temple. She wanted to remind them that Raleigh couldn't attend the party because he had a flat tire that night. Here's why this obscure reminder about his sister's birthday party and the flat tire was so important. Initially, Raleigh said that he gave Jonathan and Alex his gun on Friday, August 16th, when his car had a flat tire. They returned the gun a few days later, on Sunday, August 18th, which was the same day his dad brought him a new tire. After they replaced the tire, they went out to Pizza Hut to celebrate his birthday, which was on August 22nd. When Raleigh found out he was being questioned for the Temple murders, his story changed. He said his car actually had the flat tire the weekend of his sister's birthday party, which was on August 10th. Mrs. Kara Tachea was sitting with Raleigh for this portion of the interrogation, so she knew what the crux of the case against her son was. It all boiled down to who possessed that rifle on the night of the murders. If all of Raleigh's friends told the detectives he had a flat tire at the time of his sister's party, it would support Raleigh's story that Jonathan and Alex borrowed the gun the same weekend the monks were murdered at the temple. When Frank and Joy were asked about the evening of August 9th, the very first thing they told the detectives was that Raleigh's sister had a birthday party that night. They said Raleigh couldn't attend because his car had a flat tire. Frank and Joy explained they were hanging out at Amanda's from 7:30 p.m. until 11:30 p.m. When they got home, Joy remembered their mother telling them about the temple slayings. Detective Munley asked Joy if she was sure about the date because news of the temple murders wasn't made public until Saturday, August 10th. Joy conceded that she wasn't sure. In the other room, they asked Frank the same question, if he was sure about his dates. Frank said that he was basing his memory of that night on what Raleigh's mother told him about the birthday party and the flat tire. We can only wonder what Frank and Joy would have said had the detectives gotten to them before Raleigh's mother did. Maybe their stories would have been the same. Maybe they would have been different. We do know that both Frank and Joy conceded that their statements were influenced by what Raleigh's mother had said. The main takeaway here is that witnesses' memories are malleable. They can be reshaped by the input of other interested parties, their own biases, or even by the phrasing of an interviewer's questions. Amanda is a great example of this. When she was interviewed on October 27th, she told the detectives that she spent the weekend with her family at their home in Estrella. She never mentioned anything about Raleigh's sister having a birthday party or how Raleigh had a flat tire. They interviewed her the next day on October 28th. Again, no mention of a birthday party or a flat tire. They brought her down to headquarters for a recorded interview the next week on November 6th, 1991. This time, they asked her if she knew anything about Raleigh's sister's birthday party. Amanda did remember Raleigh's mother saying something about the party, but she thought that was in July. Amanda was interviewed again 3 months later on February 6, 1992. A report was prepared documenting that interview, and it stated the following. Amanda could not remember her activities for August 9, 1991, or the days around this date. Amanda only remembers that around the first part of August 1991, Raleigh's sister had a birthday party. Amanda did not attend this party, but she thought that the party was on a Friday night. Raleigh was to attend the party, but was unable due to his car having a flat tire at her house. When asked why Amanda remembered his sister's birthday party, she said that Raleigh's father and mother contacted her after his arrest in this case. Amanda said that Mr. and Mrs. Caratachea contacted several of Raleigh's friends. There are many reasons why you would shop at a thrift store. You might see the benefits of buying like-new clothing, as it isn't one more thing being made, packaged, and later disposed of after use, as so many things are these days. Even better, you might be the kind of thrifty individual who loves scoring great deals. Whatever your reason, we can all agree that a thrift store is a great place to shop at and feel good about. And because ThredUp is online, thrifting has never been easier. Customize your searches by size, style, and budget, and start shopping and saving today. They also have an easy return policy, so they make thrifting worry-free. When my wife was asked about her new shirt, she was able to say it was like new and from ThredUp. The quality and pricing of the items means that we have a new store to shop at, and we couldn't be happier. We think you'll love it too. Get the styles you love at a fraction of the price. You'll look and feel good with ThredUp. And for Framed listeners, here's an exclusive offer just for you. Get an extra 30% off your first order at ThredUp.com/framed. That's ThredUp.com/framed for 30% off your first order. ThredUp.com/framed for an extra 30% off today. Terms apply. Can't get enough of Framed? Binge the entire season ad-free right now with a subscription to Stitcher Premium. That's right. If you subscribe to Stitcher Premium, you can hear every episode right now without waiting each week. For a free month of Stitcher Premium, go to stitcher.com/premium and use the promo code FRAMED when you select a monthly plan. That's stitcher.com/premium, promo code FRAMED. Before Raleigh started going out with Joy, he was with Rhonda. They were together from December 27, 1990 to July 1, 1991. When they were together, Raleigh would give her roses every week. He was always writing her notes in class, too. This is probably how he earned the nickname Shakespeare. He had a way with words. He could sweet-talk the ladies, as Raleigh put it. Rhonda was first interviewed on October 28, 1991. When asked about her relationship with Raleigh, she said that they spent a lot of time together. They would either meet up at her house or Amanda's house. She described Raleigh as a natural leader who liked to be the center of attention. He was also quick-tempered and would get mean sometimes. He would usually take his anger out on his car by kicking it or punching it. When the interview shifted to the Temple murders, Rhonda said she never heard anyone in the group talk about it. She did see something about it in the newspaper when it first happened. She knew that 9 people were murdered out past where she lived and that the police were looking for a red car. That was the extent of her knowledge concerning the Temple murders. Initially, Rhonda told the detectives that she couldn't remember anything from the weekend of August 10th. When she was interviewed a second time, on February 12, 1992, her memory had improved, and here's why. Raleigh's father, mother, sister, and brother came over to her house to speak with her about it. They reminded her that the murders occurred the same weekend Raleigh's sister had her birthday party. They also told her that Raleigh's car was parked in the driveway at Amanda's with a flat tire. Suddenly, it all came back to her. 3 months after telling the detective she couldn't remember anything, she was able to provide a detailed, minute-by-minute breakdown for the entire weekend. We will spare you the full recap here, but in short, everything benefited Raleigh. There was a reason the task force was circling back to Rhonda all these months later, and it wasn't because they got word that her memory had improved. The task force received a tip that led them to believe she knew more than she was letting on. Rhonda accidentally left her chemistry book at her friend Tiffany's house. Inside the book, Tiffany found a few notes. She showed them to her mother, and they decided to turn them over to the task force. When Rhonda was interviewed on February 12, 1991, they had her provide a handwriting exemplar. An expert compared Rhonda's handwriting to the notes that Tiffany gave them, and they were a match. With the results and notes in hand, they went back to interview Rhonda a third time. They asked if she had ever written down anything concerning the Temple murders, and she said she hadn't. The detective showed Rhonda a letter that she wrote to Frank. They asked her if she had ever seen it before, to which she replied, no. They told her that their handwriting expert determined that she was the author of the letter. Rhonda held both of her hands to her head. She stared at the letter for approximately 2 to 3 minutes, making no comments whatsoever. Finally, Rhonda stated, if you say I wrote this letter, then maybe I did, but I don't remember. During this portion of the interview, Rhonda would not make eye contact with the detectives. As she stared down at the table, her eyes swelled with tears. She began biting her fingernails and cracking her knuckles as tears flowed down her cheeks. Rhonda was asked why she signed the letter, the real one, in place of her name. Rhonda then made the comment, any real investigator with any sense at all could figure out who had done this crime. She went on to say that she didn't know who the true killers were. The letter's content indicated otherwise. Here is what she wrote in that letter. Frank, hey, I hope no one like Joy is reading over your shoulder right now. I have a lot of important things that you need to know about Raleigh. He knows who the killers are. So do I, and so does everyone who takes the time and common sense to figure it out. Don't count him off as a free man yet, because he is guilty. Maybe not as charged, but he is guilty. But see, you didn't know. That's why I'm warning you. You can't keep saying he's innocent, or they'll start looking for another guilty party. And, who will it be? Love always, the real one. In addition to the letter, there was another note with an acrostic poem written on it. An acrostic poem typically has a phrase written vertically along the left side of the page. Each letter of the phrase is used to start the next line of the poem, going to the right. With this poem, the vertical phrase was, I killed the monks. When confronted with the poem, Rhonda immediately claimed credit for having written it. The poem reads like this. I sit staring at my wall, a poster of kittens clawing each other, so innocent. I sit in my room, turn on the radio, listening to songs of violence considered cool. Listen to me, because I truly know that everyone has done things like this evil. Demons run loose in your souls, binding and twining. Together to form a community of evil in the house of terror together, they will abide, and evil will rule over everyone. They asked Rhonda if she knew how they acquired these notes. She assumed they had searched her locker at school and retrieved them from her notebox. Rhonda explained that when she was interviewed in October of 1991, the detectives asked her to provide all of the notes Raleigh had written to her over the years. In response to this request, Rhonda moved her notebox from her bedroom to her school locker. Her intent was to give the contents of the box to investigators, but she never got around to it. Rhonda stated that in the box they were likely to find 3 to 7 additional letters or poems concerning the Temple murders. Rhonda then led the detectives to the school, opened up her locker, and handed over the notebox. The frame team has looked everywhere in this case file for the contents of the notebox. Specifically, we wanted to review the notes that Raleigh wrote to Rhonda and the additional poems and letters concerning the Temple murders. In spite of our efforts, we were never able to find copies of those documents. All we have is the letter to Frank, this one poem, and an expert's opinion that Rhonda's exemplar matched the letter. Since we weren't able to review all of the relevant documentation, we were unable to draw our own conclusions regarding who wrote that letter and who wrote that poem. A few things to consider, though. Raleigh's number in the AM Posse was 1. The letter to Frank was signed, the real one. This made us wonder, did the man known as Shakespeare write these letters and poems? Is that why Rhonda couldn't remember writing the letter? And think about this, if she hadn't claimed credit for writing the poem, who would the detectives have presumed wrote it? The past year has taken a toll on many of us. Whatever the reason for your anxiety, depression, trauma, or relationship issues, there is help for you. It used to be that seeing a therapist had to be a secret, but as time has gone by, more and more people are opening up about the benefits of therapy. I believe therapy is something to be proud of. You're taking time to take care of you, which can really change your life for the better. I recommend Talkspace because they have thousands of licensed therapists with years of experience in over 40 specialties. Depending on the plan you choose, you can talk, text, video, or send voice messages to your licensed therapist, so it's incredibly convenient to have virtual sessions without leaving the house. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end bank-grade encryption technology to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. Talkspace is also a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. It has never been safer or easier to get therapy. Your mental health is important. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off of your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com or download the app. Make sure to use the code FRAMED to get $100 off of your first month and show your support for the show. That's FRAMED and Talkspace.com. Vicky was Jonathan Doody's girlfriend. She was first interviewed by the task force on October 28, 1991. They told Vicky that she wasn't in any trouble, but Jonathan was. They needed to know everything she knew, who Jonathan hung out with, anything he may have said to her, details about their relationship, and so on. Vicky explained that she met Jonathan in May of 1991 in the school lunchroom. They started going steady soon after. Jonathan gave her his dad's Air Force jacket and his mother's necklace as a sign they were together. In the summer of 91, Vicky spent a lot of time away. She lived with her mother in California for a month. She also attended a leadership school in Gila Bend, Arizona for a week. After that, she flew to Las Vegas to live with her aunt. Vicky returned to Arizona on August 23rd, which was about a week before school started up. She reconnected with Jonathan once classes resumed. They would see each other every day in school, and on the weekends they would go to movies, go to football games, things typical teenagers do. As they talked through some of the background stuff with Vicky, the interview had a relatively low-key feel to it. She was laughing with the detectives. She seemed relaxed. Then things got serious. The detectives told Vicky over and over again that if she knew anything, now was the time to share it. They were going to continue their investigation and talk to more people. If they heard that Vicky knew about what they did and kept quiet about it, she was going to be in big trouble. They told Vicky, "You see, Jonathan's in custody. We've arrested Jonathan. Same goes for Alex. We're not talking about something petty or even burglaries. We're talking about murders. Do you know what we're talking about now?" Vicky said, "Yeah, I know." About a week before she met with the detectives, Vicky was with Jonathan at the park. They were sitting on some swings talking about things. Vicky opened up about some personal hardships she faced growing up. Then Jonathan shared a personal story of his own. There was something he was feeling guilty about that he needed to get off his chest. He told Vicky he was a sniper working with OSI. He was a contract killer, and so was Alex. A year before he met Vicky, he said he killed 10 to 13 people. Jonathan said he shot them all in the head. He told Vicky, "How do you think Alex and I got $2,000? The detectives asked Vicky if Jonathan was just making up stories or if she thought he was telling the truth. She said, "If someone tells me they killed someone, I believe them." The day after Vicky was interviewed, her close friend Benjamin walked into the Office of Special Investigations at Luke Air Force Base. He said he heard on the news that Jonathan was arrested and he had relevant information he wanted to share. With the help of the OSI agents, he prepared the following written statement. "I met Jonathan Doody at a Civil Air Patrol briefing. When I first met John, I was impressed with his love for the Air Force. He was the sharpest guy on color guard. Then, over the summer of 1991, we lost contact. John had been having problems with his girlfriend Vicky, and that changed his general attitude. I thought it was just a little problem between them. One afternoon, either Wednesday, October 23rd or Thursday, the 24th, John was acting upset about something, so I started talking to him. I started asking questions about him and his girlfriend's relationship. Then he got off that subject and started talking about OSI. He said that his dad was in OSI, and then he got Alex Garcia and Jonathan Duty into OSI also. He started talking about his mission, what he called Sniper. He said that OSI was involved in the Monk murders because it had to do with national security. John said, "If you ever shoot someone mercenary style, never do it within 5 feet from their head. Every time I shut my eyes, I can see and hear the blood rushing from their heads. What I have just told you, you can't tell anyone, because if OSI found out I talked to you, you will not ever see me again." He said OSI is controlled by the CIA, which is controlled by the Pentagon. John said he spent many hours doing paperwork at his office on the base. He said he shot 9 to 13 people as a sniper, and that the OSI killed John F. Kennedy because he was pulling troops out of Vietnam. "I was told this on Wednesday or Thursday and chose to ignore it until now. I came forward because John was arrested and this issue was on the news. Special Agent Steve McGibbon and John Johnson assisted me in the preparation of the statement." Now, obviously, there's a lot there to chew on. It's a bit of a head-scratcher why Ben chose to bring this information straight to OSI. They were the very people Jonathan told him were behind the Temple murders. If there was even the slightest chance he was telling the truth, that's the last place you'd want to go. The safer play would have been to place an anonymous call to the task force's hotline. But that's not what he chose to do. Instead, he prepared a written statement with the help of two OSI agents. When OSI cross-referenced their work with the task force, they would see that Ben's story was remarkably similar to what Vicky told them. They both claimed that Jonathan said he and Alex were snipers working for OSI. There was one key difference, though. With Vicky, Jonathan was vague. He claimed to have killed people in his past, but he didn't mention the temple at all. As Ben told it, Jonathan went a step further and admitted to killing everyone in the temple. We'll do some quick fact-checking on this before we go any further. First of all, Jonathan's father did not work in the OSI, and neither did Jonathan or Alex. They weren't secret agents killing people on behalf of the U.S. government, and they didn't have any inside info on the Kennedy assassination. Those details from Ben's statement are conspiratorial and patently false. The main takeaway from Vicky and Ben's statements is that Jonathan admitted to shooting 10 people in the head. Confessions can be cathartic. Maybe that's why Jonathan said these things. Maybe he created this fantasy sniper narrative as a way to rationalize what he had done. Or maybe he presented it the way he did so it would be written off as nonsense, which is what happened. However you look at it, it doesn't reflect well on Jonathan. In the days and weeks that followed, Ben was re-interviewed by the task force. He added a few more details to his story during those interviews. He stated that his conversation with Jonathan occurred during their color guard practice while they were standing under a fighter jet. He said that other people were present for the practice, including someone named John Mills. Ben remembered how Mills kept interrupting Jonathan while he was confessing to the Temple murders. They asked Ben if Mills overheard any of their conversation. Ben said, "Maybe he did, I'm not sure." Given how important Ben's story was to the case, John Mills is clearly someone the task force would have talked to. But we couldn't find a single report documenting an interview with Mills. One last detail from Ben before we move on. The detectives asked Ben if Jonathan described the type of weapon he used to kill the monks. Ben said, "Yeah, he told me he used a .45 caliber handgun." Before Jonathan confessed to being at the temple on the evening of August 9th, his original story was that he went to see Bill and Ted's bogus journey with his friend Brandon. It got out around 10 or 11 p.m. He said he dropped Brandon off at his house, and then he went home and went to bed. Brandon was first interviewed on October 29, 1991. They interviewed Brandon in a wired interrogation room, and the interview was recorded. Their standard practice was to have a court reporter transcribe what was said in the interrogation room shortly after the interview concluded. The reason they had the transcription made was because the tapes were of poor quality and it was often difficult to hear what was said when the tapes were played back. With Brandon, the task force opted not to transcribe the interview, so we reviewed the next best thing. Detective Yatsko prepared a 12-page report summarizing the interview. Per the report, they didn't ask Brandon if he went to the movies with Jonathan on the evening of August 9th. Apparently, Brandon didn't mention it either. This was surprising, to say the least. We're talking about a potential alibi witness for one of their prime suspects in the case. Surely, they would have asked Brandon what he did on the evening of August 9th. If he denied seeing the movie with Jonathan that night, it would have made their case that much stronger. Why would Detective Yatsko neglect to mention that in his report? Maybe the reason they decided not to transcribe the interview was because he said something that ran counter to the case they were building. So we decided to listen to the original audio files of Brandon's first interview. This is something we typically avoided in our research because the quality of the audio files was so poor. Here's a sample of the audio. Then we did a little cleanup to the audio with some modern software. The quality was still poor, but at least we could make out what was said. We listened all the way through tape 1, which was 47 minutes long. When we finished, we realized that the 12-page report Detective Yatsko prepared only documented what was discussed on tape 1. He ends his report by stating, "The interview was terminated at this time." That wasn't true. We still had 2 more tapes to listen to. So we listened to the last hour and 12 minutes of the interview, and we have to say, even though they did a horrible job of documenting this, their interview tactics with Brandon were fantastic. Here's an example of a bad question they could have asked. "Jonathan told us you went to the movies with him on August 9th. Is that true?" The problem with a question like this is it's too specific and it puts a lot of pressure on the interviewee to pick a side. Rather than asking questions that were leading or too narrow, the detectives asked broad, open-ended questions. For example, they asked Brandon, "How did you learn about the murders?" Brandon said, "Jonathan told me. It was that night, that Saturday night, because the murders happened sometime in the morning. They were sitting in his Mustang when Jonathan said, 'Hey, guess what? People were murdered at the temple.'" Then the detective asked Brandon what he did the day before on Friday. See if you can hear what Brandon's response was.
"The day before, Saturday, Friday, were you with Jonathan on Friday?"
Brandon let out a deep sigh as though he was thinking hard, trying to remember back to that night. Then it sounded like he said, "I think we went to the movies." Then it's a bit garbled and we couldn't make out what was said. The next thing we heard was, "We went to Amanda's, then he took me home."
"So Friday night, you were over to Amanda's, and then he took you home?"
The detective's follow-up didn't mention anything about going to the movies. Maybe we misheard. Maybe Brandon said Amanda and not movies in his initial response. So we kept listening, hoping to find something that would add some clarity. Eventually, in tape 3, we heard the detective say this.
"Saturday and Friday kind of mix up on what maybe you did that evening. Saturday, Friday, once you said that you went here, you went somewhere, maybe the movies. Did you go to Amanda's on Friday?"
In that clip, you can clearly hear the detective say, "You went somewhere, maybe to the movies." It also sounded like Detective Yatsko was frustrated with Brandon because he was getting his Saturday and Friday nights mixed up. He wanted to know which night Brandon went to the movies and which night he went to Amanda's. This is where details matter. Listen to what Brandon told the detectives happened after they left Amanda's.
"So Friday night, you were over to Amanda's. And he took you home?"
"Yeah, and he went back home."
"Really happy he went back home?"
"Yeah, his mother was murdered." "So, if you need more information about that, you could ask his mother. She should know more."
Jonathan's mother was worried the temple murders were a hate crime. She didn't want her Thai son staying out late, which means they probably went to Amanda's on Saturday night, after the Temple murders happened. Friday night was the night Brandon went to the movies with Jonathan. Alex Garcia said that it was Jonathan's idea to rob the temple. He was the one who came up with the plan. Jonathan needed money so he could buy a Ford Mustang from his friend Marvin. That was the motive that set all of this in motion. Marvin was interviewed on October 27, 1991 at 7:30 p.m. He explained that he knew Jonathan Duty for about a year. They worked together at the commissary. In early August, Marvin said he agreed to trade his Ford Mustang to Jonathan in exchange for Jonathan's Ford Escort and $2,000 in cash. Marvin believed they swapped cars on the evening of August 8th, but he wasn't sure on the date. Then he thought of something. He remembered that when they traded vehicles, Jonathan signed over the title to the Escort. The date Jonathan signed the title over was August 9th, 1991. That's when they traded cars. On the night of the Temple murders, Jonathan took on $2,000 in debt. It wasn't just the number he and Marvin were talking about, it was real. This is what Alex was talking about. Jonathan needed money to pay off his new car. So a lot of this comes down to the timing of the car payments. If Jonathan gave Marvin a ton of cash after August 10th, this would be solid proof of Jonathan's motive. So they asked Marvin when he received the $2,000 from Jonathan. Marvin said that Jonathan gave him $1,000 in cash as a down payment on the evening of August 9th when they traded keys. This means that the first $1,000 Marvin received did not come from the temple. His next transaction with Jonathan occurred on August 23, 1991, except Jonathan wasn't making a payment. He was borrowing money.
How did you guys get the money to move in September?
Jonathan had that.
How much money did he have? What do you need? Do you have to pay first, last month? Do you have to pay a cleaning deposit?
You have to pay a month's rent plus a move-in fee. The total was $410, and he borrowed $500 from this guy, Marvin. He borrowed $500 from him. And then within the weekend, he'd spent $200. So he was down to $300, and I had a little extra cash.
Jonathan borrowed $500 from Marvin so they could get the apartment in September, just like Raleigh said. The reason we know this is because Marvin and Jonathan drew up a contract on August 23rd specifying the terms of repayment. As collateral for the loan, Jonathan gave him some foreign currency and a Sharp portable stereo system. Of note, a Sharp portable stereo system was not one of the electronics known to be missing from the temple. In the fall of 91, Michelle Hoover was a 14-year-old freshman at Agua Fria High School. 2 weeks after school began, she attended an ROTC meeting with her friend Elizabeth. Michelle asked who the tall guy was across the room. Elizabeth said that was one of their sergeants. His name was Alex Garcia. Elizabeth introduced the two while they were learning how to fold the flag. Michelle's first impression of Alex was that he was funny. He had a quick wit. She thought he was easygoing. They exchanged phone numbers at the meeting and got to know one another over the next few weeks. Something they learned through their talks on the phone was that they shared a mutual interest in fast cars and guns. Before too long, they became boyfriend and girlfriend. On the weekends, they would go shooting together, go to the movies, or hang out with friends. Detective Griffiths interviewed Michelle on October 27, 1991, around 1:30 p.m. The interview took place in his squad car, which was parked in the driveway of the Hoover residence. Michelle was in the front seat, and her mother, Mrs. Hoover, sat in the back. Detective Griffiths said he had a few questions for them regarding Alex Garcia. The questions were pretty basic. Michelle told him the story of how they met. She described what Alex was like, who he hung out with, those sorts of things. Then Griffiths asked Michelle if she ever heard Alex say anything unusual or odd. Griffiths noted a change in her body language in response to this question. Michelle lowered her head and became still and silent. It seemed as though she knew exactly what needed to be said, but she didn't want to say it out loud. After 30 seconds or so, Michelle finally said, "Alex told me, no matter what happens, I'll always love you." Griffiths asked if Michelle had anything else she wanted to share. Michelle avoided eye contact and quietly stated, "No." Detective Griffiths returned to headquarters and did a little more research into Michelle. In doing so, he came across a police report that was less than a week old. On October 22, 1991, Alex and Michelle were arrested at gunpoint. Michelle didn't mention this during her first interview, and Griffiths wanted to know why. So he drove back to the Hoover household that night. He confronted Michelle with the police report concerning their arrest. He told her, "Look, you need to tell me everything you know about Alex and the situation he's gotten himself into." He asked Michelle to take it slow and explain everything. Here's what she told him. On October 14th, they decided to go out to the dunes and do some shooting. Michelle used her father's 9mm handgun, while Alex was armed with his brother's 22 caliber rifle. They were out there shooting for a little while, then Alex suggested they play a game of 20 questions. 20 questions is a game where one player thinks of a person, place, or thing. The other player can ask up to 20 questions to gather info on the thing they're trying to guess. Alex came up with the topic, and Michelle was asking him the questions. Alex started giving her clues as the game went along. By Cotton Lane was a clue. Then, monks. Finally, nine people. Michelle asked, "Does this have to do with the people at the temple?" Alex said, "Yes." What he said next stunned Michelle. He said, "That's where I got my CD player." Alex explained that they went in there to rob them, then things got out of hand. Some of his friends just started shooting. Michelle asked who else was there, and Alex said he couldn't say. The only thing he told her was, "A bunch of us went to the temple." The next day, on October 15th, Michelle was talking with Alex on the phone. While they were on the line together, she overheard a conversation Alex was having with Jonathan Duty. She heard Jonathan ask Alex about some cameras that were in his bedroom. Jonathan asked if there was any film in them. At that point, she heard Alex tell Jonathan to put them down and stop messing with the cameras. Alex told Jonathan, "We got a lot of shit out of there." Michelle interpreted that to mean Alex, Jonathan, and others acquired the cameras from the temple during the burglary. The day after she overheard this conversation on the phone, Michelle and Alex decided they were going to run away together. They stole her mother's truck and took off with no real destination in mind. The two spent a few nights sleeping in the bed of the truck under the stars, one night at the dunes and the other at the Mesquite campground along the Verde River. From there, they drove to her family's cabin in Tonto Village, Arizona. Their romantic getaway came to an end when a neighbor called the police. That neighbor's name was Bill Bolt. He knew the Hoover family, and he heard through the grapevine that Michelle was missing. When he saw Mrs. Hoover's pickup truck parked at the cabin, he called the police. Alex and Michelle were taken into custody later that night. Michelle concluded her second interview with Detective Griffiths by stating that if she thought of anything else, she would give him a call. Griffiths walked away from this follow-up interview feeling validated. His read of Michelle was that she was holding back, that she wasn't telling him the full story. He listened to his gut, put in the work, and ended up finding another state witness willing to testify against the accused temple murderers. However, when Michelle was eventually called to testify at the trial, she pled the fifth because she was also facing a murder indictment. Michelle found out that when you snitch on Alex Garcia, he'll snitch on you. There was something big Michelle left out of the story she told Detective Griffiths. Next time, on Framed. During change of plea negotiations with the state, Alex admitted involvement in a subsequent murder. Alex agreed to tell prosecutors and sheriff's office detectives about his participation and the participation of 14-year-old Michelle Hoover in a murder that occurred at the Mesquite campground along the Verde River on October 18, 1991. Music for Season 2 of Framed was created by The Captain. His website is truecrimegarage.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Framed ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.